Welcome to the podcast. It's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist. The Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee without my normal co-hosts, our head coach Chad Timmerman and Nate Pearson. Instead, I'm with the Cliff Bar guys. What's up, everybody?
How's it going?
How's it going?
Sup.
Four guys to be total here. Four racers for the team, for the pro team. And Cliff Bar, sponsored by Argon, Envy, K-Edge, obviously Cliff Bar, a lot of other Capo, right?
Capo Cycling.
That's right. Capo Cycling, the whole deal. So you guys, last year, we did a podcast all about crit racing, and it was huge. Like, people have loved that thing. So, and we gave people tips on how to race in criteriums. And this time, we're going to talk about how it's different than road racing, and we're going to focus more on the road racing side of things and go through some tips and tricks. But first, let's introduce each one of you so you, all of you listening to this, can understand who's talking. Let's start on this side. Go ahead.
How's it going, everybody? I'm Zach Allison.
And?
Hey, guys. This is Pete Morris.
He's Thor. He's the guy with the legs in Bicycling Magazine.
And I'm Michael Jasinski.
Kevin Malervy, also Ginger One.
Yes, because his twin brother is on the team now.
Yep.
So we have to differentiate there. It's good to have you guys. Now, all of you guys, how long have you been racing bikes? And when did you get to the P1-2 level and be competitive there?
Well, a long time. I started racing as a junior on the East Coast.
Nice.
I grew up in the D.C. area. And then you just kind of move up through the junior ranks and then went to school at Colorado State as I got my one upgrade, and then
Sweet.
Bounced around from teams from there.
Nice. Yeah. Awesome. And is this your, how long have you been on Cliff?
This is my first year.
First year?
Yeah, first year on Cliff.
Sweet, man.
Yeah.
Welcome to it. Pete?
I'm kind of interesting. I didn't start cycling until I was a senior in college. So I was 22, and I upgraded pretty quick. And then I was much worse in the P1-2s than I was before that. So I've been on Cliff for, this is year 7. It's the only Pro-1-2 team I've ever been on.
Sweet.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And like Pete there, I started, I believe my junior year at Chico State of college, kind of rising through the ranks at, through Chico Corsa. And this is my 5th year on Team Cliff Bar. So,
sweet.
Yeah.
Good to hear. And Kevin, you?
I've been racing for like 10, maybe 11 years.
Yeah.
Started senior year in high school and then started just like Zach in college, started moving up the ranks. I was really bad at first.
We all are.
So I've progressed a little bit, but this is my 2nd year on Team Cliff Bar.
Sweet.
Yep.
Awesome. And you guys are more known for crit racing. That's more of what the team focuses on, but you have a pretty vast amount of experience to draw from on the road racing side too. So I think it'll be cool to kind of touch on these things. The first part that I wanted to talk about here before anything was how your training differs for road racing than it would for criterium racing. And I guess first things first, we should talk about on the bike stuff. So what does the interval structure look like, or how does your training change on the bike if you're training for road racing instead of just crit racing?
If you're just like looking at specificity, that drives a lot of it, right? So the volume, obviously, if it's a road race that's 100 miles, 120 miles, then you have to train like that and get the volume in to get different adaptations. Glycogen-wise, metabolically, all these different adaptations are completely different from a crit, where it's more how can you use up as much energy as quickly as possible in your hour long or 90 minute crit. So training really drives that difference.
That's that awesome. That's like the principles behind it, right? That's perfect. So what does it look like in context? How is your interval training different, or what does like a typical training week look like if you're training for road racing compared to your crit stuff?
So I'll come in because I'm very crit specific right now.
Right.
And I'm doing like 20 or 30 minutes at 500 watts or over, and I haven't gone on a ride longer than 90 minutes.
For a while.
for a month or two.
Because right? Most of your races is
are 90 minutes,
yeah.
Right. So, I mean, I'm 100% crit focused right now, and I probably won't do a road race this year, or maybe one, two, accidentally.
Right.
And then...
accidentally.
But yeah, so since I slid that all the way over, like Zach's been training some real hours. And so like when he talks about his volume and intensity levels, like my intensity is, I mean, pretty much, you know, like closer to one, you know, or right. over, you know, like, and yeah. so.
And you're talking about one IF.
Yeah.
Intensity factor.
Yeah. So, and then when Zach goes out, he's been knocking out hours instead. Some, right?
Yes and no.
Yeah.
Definitely, like, I've been, like, we know our calendar, which is key to training for what, where we're going to be during the season for races. So whereas last year, you know, a full calendar with Gila and Philly and all, like Reading, all these
big
super long
road races,
like I know that I'm not going to be doing that same calendar. So it's definitely been more focused.
Yeah.
I haven't had many rides with an intensity factor of one being right. the whole ride at threshold as an average normalized, but, yeah. Definitely more intense than last year with as much volume. Plus Colorado kind of sucks in the winter for that sort of training.
Yeah. That's putting in those long days yeah. is pretty hard. What type of stuff did you do, Jazz, on like for like the long days, like, or I guess getting ready for road races? What would you do for that type of training? What does your training look like throughout the week?
So in getting, and the way I was seeing it here locally in Northern California, we have a race, Nevada City Classic, mm-hmm. that's essentially a 1.5 minute climb or so. And yeah. you're doing that for an hour and a half and you spend about a minute recovering at zero. You know, you're not pedaling, you're going down a hill
right.
and trying to manage your speed that way. And we did a race last summer, the North Star Grand Prix, and there was a race that essentially had a very similar steep 1.5 minute climb. However, rather than doing that every minute and a half, you're doing that every 40K up a lap. So
wow.
in between that, opposed to an intensity factor of one for 90 minutes, you're doing that intensity factor every 40K. In between that time, you're doing a lot of zone three and endurance pace. So yeah. in prepping for road races, I spend a lot more time doing those more manageable efforts that are much where we build up the hours, where you're doing 20, 30 minutes at a zone three tempo pace. So that's what I would focus on in preparations for a road race, as opposed to a crit where you're not doing that tempo pace ever. It's more on off.
Yeah, balancing that out across the spectrum makes sense. What about off the bike and the training that you guys do there? Pete, you're a big guy.
Yeah.
Kevin, you look, and I'm looking at like the opposite corners right here. Kevin, you look more like a traditional road racer, but you still slay it in crits, right?
Yeah, looks can be deceiving.
Yeah, exactly. So tell me what you guys do or how your off the bike training too differs when you look at road racing versus crit racing.
I'm a huge fan of plyo and gym stuff.
Mm.
Partially
plyo
because,
being jump training, correct?
Yeah. More, it's sort of a different way your muscles are firing in a plyo workout where you're kind of falling on your muscles or catching you, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. Whereas a concentric lift is like a normal squat where you're just raising a weight. So your muscles are strengthening or shortening to just raise that weight. But they both have different overload stimulus. But the main point just being that, especially in the winter in Colorado, like I said, you can't just ride every day and do intensity every day. So
right.
it can be a huge overload to do a gym day, and you can make it pretty specific to cycling and specific to your weaknesses. If you have a weakness, like especially for jumps and VO2 work, then it's only going to help you.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And I would say for sure, road cyclists need to focus more on road racers need to focus more on their limiting factors. Like that's a majority of people need to decide what's holding them back in a road race.
Mm.
And then that's what you kind of approach to, you want it not to hold you back, but you know, you still focus on your strengths. So like for a road race, like riding 5 hours is hard and you know, you have to do that regularly. You need some core strength. You need, you know, all of the other stuff. So if you're having a hard time after 4 hours, you need to kind of address the length and the other things that go along with that. And so focusing on weaknesses kind of increase your whole, you know, the whole race by a lot. It makes it much easier when you bring your weakness to just a normal level.
That's smart. Like for crit training, like you're talking about building power, building everything else off the bike. And then with road racing, it can be really effective to focus on those limiters. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a smart point. I hadn't thought about that. You're a smart dude, Pete. I know what you're doing. Anything?
Looks can be deceiving.
We have a lot of limiters to work on.
So one thing that, or is there anything else that you guys do off the bike for road racing specifically? Like, do you do any type of cross training specifically for road racing or anything like that? Probably more in the off season. We get that question a lot. A lot of people wonder what they should do in the off season with cross training. What do you say?
I think Zach will agree with me. Like it's so specific to the person that making those blanket statements, there's lots of exercises that work well for most people, but it's really helpful to get someone to kind of address what you have going on and your limiters, and like whether it's mobility or strength or, you know, like cardiovascular training. You know, there's always kind of looking at yourself and seeing what you need to work on is the best way to do it. And it kind of changes that thing in your brain where you're looking at yourself as a rider and as an athlete. And so if it's like, well, you just really need to stretch when you're watching TV at night for half an hour, and then all of a sudden your back's not going to hurt, your elbows aren't going to hurt. And that will, that's the low hanging fruit that you can get half an hour a day or 10 minutes a day, you know? And so it's so specific person to person, but there are lots of also good broad exercises that everybody can benefit from.
And that makes sense. I think road racing, it's a lot different from crits in that there's crits are just their action all the time. And I think speaking to, you know, as a young person, that people are so obsessed with their phones and things, it's action all the time. Yeah. Road racing, there is a lot of downtime. And something that was interesting for me was maybe 4 years ago, I got pretty into yoga. And that was an interesting thing from a mental standpoint, is just kind of being, it was from a meditative point to being kind of at, you know, 4 hours, 5 hours, that's a long time to do anything.
Yeah, you kind of enter like a you enter a meditative state on that long of a road ride by force.
Absolutely. Right? And sometimes being okay with that, that's an interesting place to be mentally. So something like a yoga practice is a good way of practicing that and just being like kind of at peace with just your body. Because a lot of people train with music or whatever, and just being like, in a race, for instance, that's not possible. So just being like, okay, in a good mental state to take on 5 hour days. That's
a great point. It'll also make you much more enjoyable to ride with if you're not the guy chatting the whole time. And when everybody, you know, you reach that point in a long ride when it's kind of understood, like things should just be quiet. You don't want to be that guy. Yeah, that's a good point. Let's go into the kit that you guys use when you're riding crits versus road races. I would assume, so most of your crits, how long in terms of like time, how long do most of your races last in a crit?
90 minutes,
90
2 minutes. Hours. Max.
90 to 2 hour, or
distance, right? So depends how slow we go, but 90 minutes to an hour, 50, hour, 55. Right.
And then every now and then there's like 100K, like either super week style or like Doylestown's 100K. So 100K is like the longest I think that our crits would get.
That's a long crit right there. Holy cow.
That's a short road race.
That's a road race with a lot of turns.
Yeah, there's a lot that can go wrong in that time frame. Looking at that and looking at adverse weather conditions that you would face in a criterium, which criteriums in most cases you're within a certain area. Obviously, weather does move, but that is something that's slightly more consistent than a road race that may be going up in elevation or covering a wide range. So I assume more layers, like what does the kit, what does it differ, I guess, in general here? How does your kit differ between the two?
I guess for myself, for a crit racing, I like to wear my skin suit.
Okay.
Just feels nice and tight, and I don't know.
It's good.
And I bet you like that part.
Oh, yeah.
It has pockets, but for the road race, like...
That's Capo style.
Yeah. That's right.
For a road race, you're like... You're out there for 5-6 hours and you have a base layer on, usually short sleeve jersey and stuff food inside it. But like for a crit, like we don't really eat much food during a race. So we don't need,
pockets.
We don't need pockets, but we do have pockets in our skin suits. And then a road race, you're going to have extra like layers, like for a rain jacket. Like if it's raining in a crit, you're not going to be wearing a rain jacket. Like
It's 90 minutes.
You just got to suck it up.
Going hard the whole time. It's honestly kind of hard to get cold in a crit if it's a good hard crit, right? Yeah. It's because you're working so hard. But a road race is totally different there.
It's like a comfort thing too. Like in a time trial or a criterium or kind of closer, like you wear a skin suit because you want to be as fast as possible. And you're not sitting there thinking of how uncomfortable you are because it's only going to be 90 minutes. Whereas like a road race, you're going to wear a jersey and layers so you can unzip and zip stuff. And like even your position might change on the bike.
Right.
But definitely different layers and just things to stay more comfortable for 4 hours versus you can kind of torque your body however you want for 90 minutes to be a little bit faster.
And are you guys on like longer rides like that? Are you the type that uses a jacket or are you a vest and arm warmers type of person?
That's a good question. That's a very good question. So I just did the Pasquina, we'll call it a road race. It's the traditional non-USA cycling sanctioned ride out in Northern California in Chico. And that's something that it's 100 miles and it's by yourself essentially. And I opted for the vest option because it was going to have extra, that's three extra pockets as opposed to maybe just wearing a long sleeve jersey and a base layer underneath it. So that gave me six pockets, extra storage.
Snacks on snacks.
Yep. And went with the Doc skincare embrocation as opposed to
I'm an embro guy.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah. As opposed to leg warmers. So gave me even more room. So you don't have to worry about taking off leg warmers halfway through the race, which
pain.
It has an issue.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Yeah. One thing about embrocation on that, it's something that a lot of people maybe don't consider with this is. It's a lot of it has an oil base in there. So it also provides kind of like a barrier for moisture. So it kind of provides a barrier from rain if you're riding in that. Yeah. And it really can help. It can also be extremely painful if you use bad Embro in the hot shower afterward. But yeah. I can vouch for the Doc skincare stuff not doing that.
So I was going to say, Embro application and takeoff. That's probably a whole separate podcast. So
Mistakes can be made.
A lot can go wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure. And the criterium, it just really doesn't make sense to be using layers like that or anything else. It's all action the whole time, but road race need to be prepared with that.
Yeah. And vest days are the best days. It's nice. Easy to remember.
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's not, you don't necessarily have to be wearing a jersey underneath during the summertime. So you can just, if you have a physique such as Pete's, you can just rock suns out, guns out all day.
Something else that, you guys mentioned there with, as far as like, or I guess getting away slightly from the actual clothing we wear, but helmets, do you use one helmet over another for crit versus road races? I mean, you guys have choices because you use Giro, right? Mm-hmm. So you have a few different choices on their helmets, but do you vary that at all, road racing or to crits, or is it all the same?
Not really. Like the helmet that we have is pretty aero, and then the vents are pretty dialed. So those Giros that we have, I don't think I would switch.
It's the synth, right?
Is that yeah, the synth. Whereas like if it was a different, like an atmosphere where it had like a ton of vents and zero aerodynamic qualities, then I might switch, but it's a pretty sweet all around helmet.
Yeah. They're kind of getting that we can have our cake and eat it with aero helmets these days. Yeah. They're not just super hot.
Anymore. So I more or less match the because our other option on the aero side is the AeroTac, and I like to match more so to weather and the helmet choice as opposed to event. Yeah.
The AeroTac is much warmer. Like in the wintertime, if it's a cold ride and you wear the AeroTac, it's noticeably better, you know, all around. So it's
it's an unmarketed benefit of most aero helmets.
Yeah.
They're warm. The fact that they're very warm, which can be good on a cold day.
But I guess on road races specifically, as I think about it, having because we wear Oakley sunglasses to be able to have the vents and to put your sunglasses on your helmet,
which is huge,
is a huge thing because you are going through changing weather conditions and sometimes you can sweat out your glasses or whatever. They get rainy and.
That's a good point. Like even considering the lenses that you use in a criterium, you pick what you're going to have and it's probably not going to vary too much. Although you guys do some twilight races where it's the sun's right in your eyes and then it gets dark.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's always fun. that's something to consider with the glasses too, what you're using on a road race. Yeah, that makes sense. I'm trying to think of the other stuff. I mean, shoes are all going to be the same. And all the other stuff with equipment is probably more. Oh, gloves. That's one thing.
Oh, yeah, gloves.
Yeah. What would that, how'd that differ?
I think for myself, I like to wear gloves in criteriums, but for some reason, I don't wear them in road races. I think because mentally, I'm prepared to crash in a crit, but not in a road race.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
And you get more protection from that.
Yeah.
I guess on the other side too, maybe if you're riding, I guess this comes into how your bike's set up, but for damping, having a little bit extra padding in your gloves, you're going to be spending a long day on the bike.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if it's rough roads at all, I mean, even having a pair of gloves, like if you know a rough section's coming up or something and pulling them out of your pocket and putting them on, like can make a difference over the course of 5 hours or, you know, like the, what's the one that's in winters? That used to be a good with the rough road into the climb. Do you remember that one, Jez?
Rough road into Leesville Gap.
Leesville Gap.
R.I.P. Leesville Gap. shout out fellow promo.
But that was one where you would wear gloves just for the first 45 minutes of the race, and then
it
take
was so rough.
It was so rough. But I'm not a glove guy. I think if I'm racing my bike, I don't wear gloves. Sort of is how I think about it.
Huh. Yeah. And that I know that I did that long Everesting ride. It was 222 miles, just brutal.
That looked so fun while you were doing it.
you were watching the snap story. Yeah.
From my couch, that looked great.
Yeah, yeah. And I had like numbness for like a month in my hands after that. It was pretty brutal because it was rough roads, yeah. And yeah. So yeah, I can understand that. Let's get into the bike setup. So all of you guys are on Argon 18s. They make. The Gallium Pro is their road bike, and then the Nitrogen is their aero bike. Is that right?
Yeah.
Check
correct.
Me out.
Yeah, look at you.
Nice.
Dialed.
Awesome. So all of you guys, I'm looking in the room right now, and there are so many. I don't know how you keep them straight and remember which one's which, but you guys have a bunch of these bikes all around right now. And all of you are on the Nitrogen. I think everyone is, right?
Yeah.
You focus on criteriums. That makes sense. Would that change if you were to go over and do a road race? Would you? Because granted, it's a long time over a whole day, so you could get more aero benefit, but comfort.
The Gallium Pro is a wonderful race bike. And like if I wasn't a racer, I would absolutely have a Gallium Pro. It's comfortable. It feels nice. It's a great bike. I think most, I would say a handful of the guys on the team still have Gallium Pros in their garage at home for like normal rides or training rides and things like that because it really is a great bike. So, but since we are so specific, it's sort of, you know, robbing ourselves of some advantage if we rode the Galliums instead of the Nitrogens.
Yeah. On a road race, would you switch at all, Zach? Or which
I wouldn't switch. The bike feels good, and for most of the road races, the roads are pretty good. You know, you're not on gravel roads, Chico, I guess, but you can find, like, you know, the really rough sections, but for the most part, you're going to have more benefit, like, being on the aero bike. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of other teams, especially Argon teams, even like Astana now is on Argons, and they're going to be on aero bikes. And there's not a weight penalty for the aero bike. It's, like, just a really well-put-together bike, so... And then I feel that for how rough the road is, like tire choice and wheel choice are going to make kind of the biggest difference for feeling good across the whole road race. So you get like a wide Envy wheel and a wide tire and a nice supple Maxxis tire. And like, that's going to change the road feel way more than like a road bike. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a really good point. You can, because the longer you spend out in the wind on a bike, which you're always in the wind because you're moving on a bike, the longer you spend out there, you are going to have more aero benefit on that bike. So you don't want to sacrifice that. But, and the usual claim is I want more comfort, you know? So they'll go for something that even like, you'll see a lot of guys go for like the, like, I'm like the bikes with the massively tall head tubes and they're more flexy, but you're losing a lot of aero benefit with
that. That's not stretching while watching TV at night more than the head tube, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's a really good point. Wheel choice could differ. So what would you change in that case if you're looking at like going from, it doesn't have to be model specific or it can, but how would your tire choice or how would your wheel choice differ from a crit to a road race potentially?
And pressure.
Yeah, right. Pressure too.
Mostly pressure probably, I would say.
So you'd probably run the same tires, just different pressure?
Wheels and tires are fast. You know, if they're fast in a road race, then they're fast, like aerodynamic wise, then they're going to be fast in a crit as well.
Yeah.
For the cornering aspect, you make and break the last few laps being all out in certain crits in the corners where it has speed limits in the corners. So, pressure, I'll run lower even if like maybe I think it feels slower.
Yeah.
For a contact patch. And then with all the latest research from like Zip and the Silka Diaries and everything on tire pressure, there's just so much to learn about. You're probably running too much pressure.
Yeah.
So there's just so much out there right now on figuring out what the best rolling resistance is for your tires, for your weight and what you're doing to get that contact patch round.
That's a really good point. We did a whole podcast with the guys from Flow Cycling, and they broke down tires and wheel aerodynamics to a really exact science. And it was really cool. We learned a lot. And that very thing that you can change not only the handling characteristics of your bike, but in most cases, I mean, I'm sure there's somebody out there that's running like 23C tires and 50 PSI and that's not good, but you get those wider tires and you can run low pressure and you get a much better handling bike.
I think a difference in the crits in the road race is it's never good to flat. And however, going from 0 to 30 in a crit after flatting isn't the greatest thing. However, your race isn't over. So in a crit with all this science that is saying lower pressure is better, it feels good, you can kind of err on the side of low and you're okay with that risk of flatting because your race isn't over.
Yeah.
Of course, there's 10 laps to go or whatever. And that's,
you can take that free lap.
Yeah, that's a difference. So you can't take that free lap. If you're training out by yourself and you're 3 hours away from your house, or we've all done local road races with no wheel support or whatever, and a flat ends your day. So I err on the side of more pun not intended. I err on the side of higher tire pressure on road events and longer days, just because flatting is much more of a penalty in a road race.
Yeah, a flat can, if you're looking at gaining 40 seconds over 40K, you know, with a more aerodynamic setup or better rolling resistance with a different pressure, you can lose a whole lot more than 40 seconds with a flat.
Much more.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's a good thing to keep in mind. Would you change the position of your bikes at all if you were doing road races primarily or compared to criteriums primarily?
I haven't really. Like transitioning from like a purely, not purely road race, but a road race, stage race focused schedule to a crit schedule. Maybe I'm maybe a little bit more forward.
Okay.
And a little bit higher. Mm-hmm. But so that's something you can look at. There are a lot of people that do that. But I think there's a position that you're most efficient in, and then you train in that position and it's going to be more efficient on the climbs. That would be the only thing that'd be different would be if you are a pure climber, then you're going to have a different position than a pure sprinter as a rider phenotype.
But yeah. I noticed that a lot of you guys, you're running, you guys have Envy all over the place on your bikes, but you're running Envy bars and they seem narrow on top and then the drops flare out, right? So it's 38 centimeters on top, something like that. And then you guys are like 40
or
44?
Yeah, it's four, or I should not misquote this. It's like 3.5 centimeters difference between the top and the bottom.
Okay.
But having that slightly narrower position, like I run 44 bars, but they're 39.5 at the top or 40.5 at the top. And so they're so comfortable that I was just telling someone this morning, I wish I could have those bars on all my bikes pretty much, because now that I'm used to that narrow top and wide flared bottom, like it's so comfortable that I wouldn't change a thing.
And in criteriums, I see you guys actually spend a good amount of time on the tops instead of the drops. And
tops being the hoods.
And tops being on the hoods. You're not just sprinting with your hands in the center. But you spend a good amount of time on the hoods versus the drops. And what's your reasoning there?
I'm a pure hood guy. I mean, pretty much, unless I'm actually sprinting, I'm in the hoods, and that's where I'm the most comfortable and I feel the most secure and aero. And we're never on the last couple laps when you're really taking corners, but you know, when you're only doing the corners at 85 or 90%, you can take them in the hoods pretty mellow, and it's more comfortable and a stronger position for me.
A little bit more. So, and to make it clear, it's not like you're on the hoods with your arms straight.
I'm pretty flat. Like
you
my elbows
have like
are,
90 bends.
Yeah. I pretty
arms.
Much have 90 bends and I kind of fit my bike more for my hoods because that's the type of rider I am. Like, if I can sprint pretty well, but I'm not really going to be sprinting at the end of most races. So I focused on fitting my hoods more or less for my bike.
Would that change if you're going to a road race, spending longer days there?
Yeah.
Change that around?
I think I would run the exact same. I mean, to be honest, and since I think my bike's really comfortable and I would just run the same and hang out in the hoods most of the time, just like that. Yeah. On the descents, you know, you're in the drops, but other than that.
Something to consider for sure. If you're going to be spending a long day in the saddle in a road race, you can accumulate a whole lot of fatigue elsewhere outside of your legs by riding in the drops the whole time if you're not used to that. Or, you know, you can also cause a whole lot of, you know, I guess loss if you're talking about aerodynamic loss, if you are uncomfortable there. So you're sitting upright the whole time, you know,
and you watch someone who gets uncomfortable and as they sit up straighter and straighter in the road race, and you can tell the guys who are hurting by how like, you know, yeah. they really straighten up their back and yes. stretch it out before the end. And you're like, yeah, that guy's in trouble anyways. It doesn't matter that he's stretching his back now.
Oh, we're gonna, let's we're going to get into that. All the different tactics and like the telltale signs that you guys look for. I think that's going to be interesting. Some other things that you guys might do, bottle cages in a crit. Do you run two bottle cages and two bottles in a road race? You do,
sure.
But in a crit, is that different?
I think I always run two bottles. I mean, 90 minutes, it's pretty long. And there's no feed zones in a crit. So you got to go into the race prepared with all the food and water. So even though it's 90 minutes, I think it's important to stay hydrated. And I don't know if it's just more mentally for me. But yeah, if I'm not drinking and I don't finish at least a bottle and a half by the end of the race, I think it's more of a mental game.
Yeah, that's one thing with criterium racing too. It's hammer on, hammer off, a lot of surging. And if you do have that, because I see a lot of guys in crits like, oh, I don't need a bottle. It's an hour long, you know? And sure, I guess you could say that you don't need it, but you do have time to drink in a criterium. You'll be kind of pukey, but you'll have time to drink.
Yeah.
So that's a good point.
And we just had a talk with Jack over at a nutritionist with Cliff Bar, and there's really hard evidence and science saying that being hydrated is a good thing when you're doing a sport.
I think it's fair to rely on that.
I think that's a fair, I'm not a scientist, but I'm confident in making that statement. I think the more liquid you can take with you on a bike ride or any sporting event is a good thing. And I think, you know, and through road racing and crits, regardless of, you know, what my nutrition is and how, you know, thirsty or whatever I am, the amount of times that a teammate has come up to me or I've gone to a teammate and asked them if they have any water, any food, whatever, I think it's just always a safe thing to take two water bottles.
You always can throw a bottle if you don't need
it. Exactly, yeah. There's on a finishing climb, maybe you chuck your bottles to have, like, a couple hundred grams less, but for the last couple laps of a crit, it's so fast and generally pretty flat that these bikes are probably even designed aerodynamically to have bottles in the cages. So it's probably aerodynamically slower to throw your bottles.
That's a good point.
And then the weight doesn't matter as much. So you might as well have like some electrolyte or even recovery. If you're doing a super long crit series, you know, 20-day crit series, then you can just have recovery for the last few laps and really dial in your nutrition. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Smart.
And lastly, I'm a big guy and I get hot. You know, and so I'm a sprayer too. So I like spray my legs down. And most of the races we do, I feel like somehow we always race in 95 degrees. I don't know what it is, but that's so the cooling aspect, like I would always rather have a bottle for cooling, even if I don't drink it because in a road race, especially, you know, there's so many hot road races where if you have a little extra to spray yourself down, I think that definitely for me makes a bigger difference than the 200 grams I'm missing from my bottle for sure.
And I don't want to make things too visual here, but you got to keep it cheap. But something that I see, so Nino Schurter, one of the best mountain bikers in the world, he's constantly spraying down. He has, when he goes to the feed zone, he takes the first bottle, drinks it, then he drops that. Keep in mind, these guys are doing, you know, a lap in 15 minutes, 10 minutes, right? So that he takes a bottle, he drinks almost the whole bottle, it looks like he squeezes a huge amount. And then after that, he has a second bottle every time. And that second bottle is not for him to keep on, but he sprays off the top of his thighs and his lower back. Where do you spray off?
So the legs, or like when you're moving quickly, the legs evaporate really quickly. So if I can spray my whole, like kind of from the thigh down, and then that evaporates and cools you down a whole lot. Top of the hands are good too. And for ice packs, like in your lower back, I usually have things in my pockets like phones or something, so I don't spray my lower back, but I'm sure Nino doesn't.
Yeah. concerned with weight, I'm sure.
Yeah. For me, my biggest noticeable thing is legs and down the back, right? So if you're just a little damp, you're so much cooler.
Yeah.
And if someone was handing me a bottle every 15 minutes, you could be sure I would be doing that.
Yeah, it makes sense, right? Like, I mean, if 75% roughly of your energy consumption is going just to cool you off when you're riding, you should really help out that process. One thing I see a lot of people do is they spray their heads. And while you may feel like you have a really hot head and everything else, a lot of those guys, you see them drop their glasses shortly thereafter because it just covers your glasses. And
nice, yeah.
It also, if you have a bottle of mix, never spray with that. worse than you're just a gross
sticky
mess.
You've got to be in dire situation to spray mix on your legs.
Yeah, it's pretty gross. So I think that, and also in a road race, would you carry, I mean, if it's a supported road race, you probably wouldn't, but if it's a road race where there isn't neutral support or anything like that, you don't have a team car, would you carry any type of tools or anything else with you to get yourself out of a pinch?
No,
I don't think so.
Yeah.
No.
I think maybe a third bottle if like it's super hot and feeding doesn't open until say 30K or something like that.
Good.
But yeah, you're just kind of going back to the caravan for everything that hopefully doesn't go wrong, you know?
Yeah.
But then you always got to go back for bottles anyway. So usually you try to make sure everything's dialed before.
That makes sense.
Yeah, a third bottle is never a bad. You can always decide 5 minutes into the race that that third bottle was a bad call, anyways, and throw it away. So, but there's many times where all of a sudden you're 2.5 hours into something and you still are only on your third bottle that you brought, and your life is much better that because you hauled that around. So, there's I think, depending on the person, it's almost like a 90% rule. Bring a third bottle with mix or something. So you can even take a big pull.
Your emergency
bottle. Yeah.
I had a teammate the last couple of years, and you could tell if he was driven to get into the break, if he had how many Red Bulls he had in his pockets on the start line.
Ooh, he's
sometimes
going big
he'd
today.
Make the break in the first like 20K and come back in the first 50K with no more Red Bulls.
He was jacked. one thing, if you guys did have to carry tools, where do you carry them? Are you, because I mean, for a lot of us that just do like average road races with like zero neutral support, you know, we are left to whatever we have. Are you a saddlebag type of person, or do you get all clever and have things that are built into your bike, or do you just carry them in your jersey pockets?
I like the saddlebag. I mean, I don't like much weight in the back because I think I have a weak lower back.
Okay.
So just stuffing like food and tools and pumps and everything back there, it just starts aggravating your back more.
Okay.
Yeah, I do saddlebag.
I do saddlebag too. I remember, this is off topic, but I remember reading something, I forget which book it was, but it was like this really romantic notion where it's just like, your bike should only carry you, and I was like anti-saddlebag, and I would carry things, and then I used a saddlebag.
It's very
like,
Belgic.
Yeah, it was like,
to use your pockets for those things and not your bike.
Exactly, but on a road race, and it's so, you could, I suppose, use a bento box, but it's much easier to.
You will be mocked.
You will too be. Sorry, yeah. I mean, that is too far. However, you can carry nutrition in your pockets, and I think that space is at a premium, especially on a long day. So, freeing up as much space as you can for cliff bars, shots, those sorts of things.
Little cliff blocks.
Cliff blocks, yeah.
Please tell me you're not.
Yeah, I don't know what shots are.
Stick.
Shots? Cliff shots?
Yeah, just, no, the
yeah, please tell
oh,
me.
Oh, yeah, no, shots.
No. Please tell me you guys are not the type to lick and stick.
The whole top tube is just covered. No, I do the tops of my handlebars.
He does not do that. That's something I see a lot of people do like on longer days. Like you can tell how long or how bad of a day they're anticipating they're going to have because like the top tube is just like lined up with little soldiers on there, the cliff blocks just stuck to the top, and it's not a good idea for your frame's clear coat or for anything else to lick and stick.
Sandy cliff blocks,
and very gross too. Yeah, because it'll all be covered in dirt and sweat.
And sweat, yeah,
yeah. So, anybody, are all of you saddlebag people?
I like the way my bike feels without a saddlebag more.
That's a really good point because you're putting the weight high up, far away from the center of gravity.
I can feel when I have a saddlebag, and so actually I put on a saddlebag to come to camp because we were riding longer than I normally ride.
Right.
But I'm a pocket guy, and I wear vests like 90% of the time I ride. So I'm
best
a six pocket guy.
Days.
Yeah. So I'm a six pocket guy. So that means I can have tools and tubes and. So that feels better on my body than having a saddlebag on my bike. So at home, I'm saddlebagless, and on probably a real road race, I would have a saddlebag. I mean, if it's non-supported and at camp and long 5-hour rides, saddlebag, it's necessary, but it's not the way I would choose to be.
Something that's important too with saddlebags is get one that stays close to your bike and isn't wagging around, you know?
No dingleberries.
Yeah, that's definitely an annoyance. Let's go into the tactics side of things, and let's just start way before a race and race selection. So with road racing specifically, How do you guys select road races for you individually? Like, which ones would you be, would you select if you could pick? What would the course be like? What would the race be like?
Rollers, nothing with like a longer than a 2 minute climb, at least for this squad, I would think.
I think we're all about in that category. However, I think back and I did way more road racing when I was first starting out and a couple of years ago. And it was really, in looking back on it now, I was just so into this whole new road biking thing. And I really am happy with how many road events I did, ranging from the Everest Challenge down in Bishop, which is just pure climbing, down to, you know, a Dunnigan Hills, which is a flat, windy road race. There's so much variety in road races. And I think if you're just getting into it, really just learning how to ride a crosswind, how to ride a climb, you know, it's... there's benefits to all of that, and you'll grow as a cyclist if you through road racing if you do all of those things. And you aren't, you know, at this point we're kind of honed in on a certain type of race, which is a rolly, you know, crosswindy kind of a day is what we excel at. But it took a long time of trying everything to figure that out, because I wouldn't have necessarily gravitated towards that from the very beginning when I was getting into cycling.
I think if you're just getting into it and you're making your own calendar, like, pick races that are good for your strengths and then train for them if they're hard enough that you have to train your weaknesses to make it to the end. But then as a team, we kind of have the calendar selected, and then we have to go whether or not we're going to be ideal for that race. And then sometimes we're working for the team if we know we're not going to make it to the finish, we're getting bottles. And then some days it is your day and you expect other people to work for you. So cool. As a team, it kind of drives it differently than an individual amateur sort of picking their own race calendar.
That's a really good point. When you look at a team, it's really like you should look at all the different resources you can put together for those races. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You made a good point, Jazz, about trying to find whatever your strengths are, whatever you enjoy best.
Yeah.
And just kind of throwing yourself at everything. And I see a lot of people, like when they first start riding, they're a big guy. So instantly they say, oh no, I'm terrible at climbing and I'm terrible. I don't pick races that are, you know, involve climbs. But so many times I've seen big guys actually do, comparatively speaking to the people that they're with, they do well on the climbs. And it's, that's a really good point. You shouldn't sell yourself short or lock yourself in too soon.
Yeah. And you just, like Jazz was saying, you learn so much. And if you're a big guy, you learn to ride better on a climby course. Mm-hmm. Like you just have to, right? And so I definitely think throwing everything at all the races you can get your hands on, especially when you're starting out, that's the best ideal. You'll learn the most over and over, and you'll, just because you're not good at something doesn't mean you can't do it, right?
Yeah, and you mentioned learning how to ride the course if you're a big guy, and you're not talking about learning how to climb very efficiently. You're talking about learning where to dose your efforts, right?
Yeah, I was, when Zach was talking about riders having their spots on the race. We did Tour of Battenkill a couple years ago, which was really fun. And I wasn't going to make it up the super steep pitches. And so my job, the first 40K, was to keep the race together. Right. And that's like an hour of me covering every single move that goes, no matter what.
You were cooked.
And it took a long time to get to the end after that. But I think I was 10 minutes off the back by 50K.
Yeah.
But I, you know, that was my role. And that's where I could do the most help for the team.
Yep.
And it did help, you know, then the race was in our control for what it was, considering what I could do. That was the only place I could actually be effective in the race. So, but like that course is steep, punchy climbs over and over again. So for a big guy, like you should probably be at the front when those steep, punchy climbs start, and then go all the way to the back over the course of the climb, and you get that extra 10 or 20 seconds up it. You don't have to climb as hard, right? So that's like those big guys in climbing races, when they're shouldering their way to the front, those are the guys that know what they're doing for sure.
I've seen Pete do that very thing at our local Tuesday Night World Series. There's a race called Boca. We've talked about it a bunch on the podcast. It's a road race, and there's some steep climbs on it. They're like anywhere from, you know, 3 to 5 minute or 2 to 5 minute climbs.
Yeah.
There's a whole series of them. So there are a lot of rollers, but there are also steep climbs that put a guy like you back. And every time Pete shows up, or when Pete shows up these days, he just like the gun goes off and he's gone and all of us have to chase back up because he knows that he's going to get drugged back on those long climbs. So it's smart.
And big guy, I mean, if you do have,
and we know we can't let you out too far, but
yeah, now
we
know
that too.
Yeah.
So it's smart. So we have to work harder than we would otherwise.
And like, depending on the type of rider you are, like a diesel guy like me, like I know if I make the whole race hard leading into the climbs are going to be easier.
Yeah.
Like I can only go so hard, but if everybody's a little tired going into it, that's a much easier climb for me. So like it's more about racing for your type of rider, no matter the course, rather than racing the course. So that, like, yeah.
Let's flip that on its head, and let's say there's a smaller dude that's very good at climbs. What would you be very frustrated to see him do? Something that would really kind of put you in a bad spot. What would be a good strategy for him, for somebody that is good at climbing?
And
let's look at like this. Okay. Let's look
just
at
say
like
drag the climb, like make sure Pete's on your wheel if you're a little tiny climber guy. And then just like listen to his breathing until he either like stops breathing or can't hear him anymore. But if he's on your wheel, then you're going to crack him while he's trying to stay with you. If you just attack, Pete's going to let you go and he's probably going to come back on the downhill or the false flat.
Okay.
But if you break him on the climb, and I'm not saying I'll do this because I'm not that climber either.
No, but
then he'll be gone forever.
Okay.
And that's because Pete's a very mature rider and knows his ability really well. And coming from like a teammate standpoint and riding on climbs with Pete and trying to get him over the top of things, it's if you're riding for a bigger guy and trying to get him to the finish line, you want to keep it, you know, focusing on your power meter or you meter your efforts. You want to keep it as steady as possible as opposed to jumping with all of the and just trusting in yourself and your own abilities. And not going with every, you know, obviously if there's a move, that's the move. And that takes some savviness and time to see that like unfold in front of you. But just trust in your abilities and ride at your tempo, your pace. And because if you explode, you explode. And that's the day. And you want to keep it at, you know, as easy as possible. And for a bigger guy, that's generally avoiding a lot of accelerations on a climb.
Yeah, I was going to say a good example is at Boca, the one we were talking about, there's a climb on the way back about 10K from the finish, right?
Yeah.
6 miles or something like that. And it's 3 or 4 minutes long. And I think Dave Christensen, if it's easy going into that and a small climber attacks as hard as he can up the climb, it's a close race whether I can catch him by the end.
Yes.
And so if they can get 20 seconds, I could maybe pull back the 20 seconds, but I bet I'll be within, it'll be like 100-foot difference. And Dave's beat me that way for sure.
Yeah. So you'll try to make it harder leading into that climb to take something out of his legs on that climb then.
But so if he has teammates or something that just, you know, stick on you. And, but so my biggest problem is if the race is very easy and then we hit a climb and then the climbers go real hard, that messes me up really bad.
You need the race to be hard.
Yeah. I need the race to be hard. So if it's like most road races, the real problem for me is that it's easy, hard, easy, hard, easy, hard, and very hard. And so I don't train for that very well. It doesn't agree with my power profile very well, and it messes me up.
You're just giving it all away, dude.
Yeah.
Quiet.
luckily I don't do those anymore. So
if you're the dude that does relish the climbs and then Pete ends up taking off, let's just say, or a rider ends up going off long before you get to the climbs, should the good climber, should he chase that move and should he stick with you? Clearly if he has teammates, it's great, but let's say he doesn't have teammates. Should he try to stick with you or should he let you go? What would you say? Trying to get him the most success, this climber guy.
I would say if you are a climber like that, if you can get with me and then it's up to you to kind of make it, then it's up to me to win, right? It's not up to him anymore. He made it. He got across, he did what he had to do. And then like, that's it. Now it's up to me to make him lose rather than him win. Right. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's up to me to win the race and he just has to hang and see what he can do. So I think if there is a big guy off the front and you can get to him on the climb by yourself, and then there's the two of you, you have the power to keep it rolling. But it's reading the race and knowing whether the guy off the front is actually going to be able to be the helpful one and whether you can beat him. But sometimes second place is better than, you know, it's all, you got to take into account all those things. But I would say you got to do all these races and try all these things and figure out what works for you. So you better try going from the gun. You better try going on the climb. You got to try all these other things too, because you never know sometimes.
Yeah. What are the telltale signs that you guys look for? And this can be similar to crit racing for sure too, but what are the telltale signs that you guys look for in a person's strategy and how they're actually riding, or in how they're dosing their efforts, or maybe like you mentioned, the stretching the back and stuff like that. What are the things you look for? And once again, this can be shared across crit and road racing, but what are the telltale signs of that you're looking for in other people during a road race to kind of figure out where they're at?
You can see it in their form a lot. Like if they're pedaling squares is kind of the saying, or
which means like inconsistent pedal stroke, or
If it just looks like they're taxed just to pedal
smooth.
Yeah. Whereas if they're looking light on the pedals and they're not shifting a ton, they're kind of comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
They look comfortable. Then they probably have some energy to spare and you should wait for them to tap into that.
Hmm.
I think a lot of times too in a road race and thinking about it and just going back to Pascana, which I keep doing just because that's so fresh in the mind. But if you see guys that you know are strong riders and they're coming kind of overdressed and then you see them start to shed layers as they go, you know that they're looking for later in the race. Yeah. And if you see somebody like that's you haven't really noticed and they've kind of been hanging out in the back or whatever, and you see him losing like a rain jacket or a heavy layer, you're like, that's
about to get serious. That's
somebody to keep an eye on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
We call that taking the gloves off.
Yeah.
You know, you can see someone when they're, and a lot of people are bad at showing or good at showing what they're going to do. They can forecast what they're going to do. And you can see people,
which isn't something you necessarily want to do.
Yeah, no, yeah. You want to, I mean, ideally you want to keep everything close to the vest.
Yep.
Another vest reference. I would say, and paying attention to other people that you're riding with, like Jazz was in, Pasquini was in a group of 8 or 10 or something, and keeping tabs on the 8 or 10 guys, whether you're rotating through or whatever, you can see a lot with very little, just by paying attention to what everybody else is doing.
Yeah, so go ahead.
I would say paying attention to guys like eating and drinking, and then watching shoulders starting to rock. Or I think the biggest thing I look at is like when guys have their head down, just staring at their computer, you can tell they're in the box.
Yeah.
And that's time to attack if you can, when guys are just totally cooked, looking down and rocking shoulders.
It's kind of easy to overthink it too, as far as like watching everyone around you. Like at the end of the day, there's kind of good moves and bad moves tactically. Like if the race is really hard and then it hits a climb and it's a crosswind and it's time to attack, it doesn't really matter like who does it or who's that fresh. If you're not fresh, you can get away with a lot by being in the right place.
That's
so sometimes
point.
You can like overthink looking around at people and being like, oh, I took his vest off, but maybe he's just hot, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Another thing that I think a lot of guys do, you'll see, and it can be difficult to read perhaps, but like skipping poles when you're in a breakaway or when you're at the front of the race. What does that tell you when a guy skips a pole?
Well, I think it's hard to tell, but that's going back. We have to like read guys, because guys can either skip a pole because they're actually cooked and they're not going to make it to the finish line, or they're skipping poles because they want to out sprint you at the end of the race. So you just got to watch, like when guys start skipping poles and then someone attacks, but that guy can respond, then you know, like he's just sitting on just to sit on to get some rest for the finish. So,
and that's something in crit and road racing that's really, I think we would all agree, is part of the fun of it. It's like a poker game. It's like, it's calling out people's bluffs, and sometimes you're feeling terrible and somebody may look good, but you don't know that until you attack and they have to follow you. So that's, that is part of the fun of it.
Awesome. Some other things that I guess you deal with more often in road racing than you do in crits. So feed zones, what's proper feed zone etiquette? And are there things that you see with feed zones that riders do that frustrate you at all, or are dangerous, or anything else?
Attacking in the feed zone?
Not okay.
Cool.
I think cycling, I don't want to stereotype people, but some people may not have played ball sports or have the hand-eye coordination necessarily to be able to grab a bottle from somebody. And I think that a lot of times that could psych somebody out and they maybe go too fast in that. But I think slowing down, being together and saying like, okay, I'm going to slow down and I'm going to grab this water bottle from somebody if you're fortunate enough to have a feeder.
Yeah.
I think that's would be my advice to somebody is like, take your time with it, grab the water bottle and then hit it, you know, and maybe that like energy spend, like, sure, that's going to be a bummer, like minute or whatever to catch, to, you know, get to whatever position that you were at. Mm-hmm. But that minute you spend is going to be much nicer with a water bottle an hour from now, you know?
That's a good point.
So it always bums me out.
And a quick thing to really, it's so easy, is tell your feeder to be at the end or the beginning or the middle. So you know when to look for them. So you're not spending the whole feed zone, you know, scanning, trying to find your person. And if you have your vest that you give to the feeder, so they're wearing it, so you recognize your feeder, you know, it's two little things that make it so easy and kind of relieve some of the pressure of the feed zone. So you know you don't have to be there right at the beginning, or you know you have to be there right at the beginning, and then you have it and then you pull over, you know, you get kind of away from the mess of the feed zone.
Another benefit of colorful kit. I have turquoise vest. It's perfect.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And tell your feeder to be chill. Like if grandma's in the feed zone and like she's in town, she's never done it before, like she will take her job super seriously and will crash out everyone to get you that bottle. And then when she still fails, she will throw it to you.
Yeah.
Which is also a no-no.
If you have somebody, tell them throwing the bottle is never a great option.
Like, tell them
don't to toss it.
Yeah, no, they might as well just stand there and close their eyes, and that's better for everyone.
Yeah.
You can grab the bottle.
That's a good practicing feed technique. As silly as that sounds, it's and also swallow your pride, because you've probably not caught a bottle every time. So
and don't hold the bottle flat on your hand pointing up. You hold on to the top of the bottle, and then there's some resistance when you grab it.
Yes,
makes a big difference.
Yeah, I am in the same way. I don't like if you just hold it up like that. It's so easy to tip it off. But hold the tops, and I can grab more of the bottle to grab too. Makes sense.
Absolutely.
Is there anything else in feeds that when you get into the higher level, you might have musettes and everything else that you're actually picking up. So a small bag with stuff in it. But do you feel like that's necessary at most races that, I mean, most of the people that are listening to this aren't going to be doing pro races or anything too tough. Should they bring a musette to a feed zone, or should they just keep it bottle and maybe a gel?
Most road races, you know how long the race is and how long it's going to take and all the nutrition you're going to need. So just have that stuffed in your pockets beforehand.
Yeah.
And then just have the feed zone just for like water and nutrition. You can always put like a gel into the top if necessary.
Yeah.
They can screw it into the top so you have a gel and a water.
Just the top of the gel kind of sticking.
Yeah. Like taping a gel on isn't necessarily a bad thing to do. Yeah. And having food, especially, I mean, we're all in it together, having food for a buddy, you know, we're all racing each other, but having food for a buddy or whatever, teammate, it's never a bad thing. So
yeah, that's a good point. Mechanicals, if you do have neutral support or team support, I guess the same principles somewhat apply, but what do you do if you get a flat in a road race and there is support in the race? You're not just completely alone to take care of it yourself.
Beg them to pace you back on.
Beg the team, the neutral support car.
Neutral support car,
yeah. And pull over to the right side of the road.
Okay.
Right?
So do you put your arm up too?
Yeah, I was going to say, so starting from some the proper etiquette and from experience, the proper etiquette is, unless it's like a huge puncture blowout and you just like feel it going, you like raise your hand. So that alerts people around you, and you're going to want to keep pedaling. Mm-hmm. You don't just stop pedaling in the middle of the pack. You want to keep pedaling, and with your hand up, that alerts people behind you, next to you, to avoid you. So you're just going to want to essentially pedal slower than everybody at a slower rate, slow down and drift to the right side of the road. And in that way, a car from behind you can service you. And if that's the case, there's a caravan, there's going to be the referee right behind you who's going to alert your team car or the neutral service that there's somebody on the side of the road with a flat. And then that alerts them, you know, to get a wheel ready or whatever. And then it kind of all goes into motion from there. But
and you keep pedaling until the car honks at you or, you know, pulls up in front of you.
Don't just stop.
Never just stop. So just keep pedaling.
Yeah, that's a great point. And don't do what you see in the tour or anything else when guys get frustrated and throw their bikes.
No. I mean, it depends how far you can throw it. If you throw it down something, that's pretty cool too.
Yeah, that is cool.
And if you do throw it, money side up, always. That's drive side.
Yeah, drive side, yep. One thing that on drive trains with neutral service, I'm sure there are a lot of people that are always wondering if it's worth it to upgrade to the latest. I mean, 12-speed drivetrains could be hitting road at some point. We don't know. They're already on mountain bike side of things. But that's something to keep in mind, too. You can, in many cases, put your wheel in with neutral service, like a spare wheel. And if you do that, it's a good idea, especially if you have something like a 10-speed drivetrain, because chances are that neutral service car isn't going to have a 10-speed drivetrain or 10-speed wheel in there, so or wheel with that cassette.
Yeah, if you put your name, like your last name, on your wheel, put it through the spokes mm-hmm. or on the cassette or something, and then you can yell your last name as they're digging through the back, and usually that helps. Or they're just going to give you someone else's wheel, which is probably more likely.
Yeah,
but
which means it won't shift right.
Yeah, but at that point,
you're moving forward.
Yeah,
on the neutral service support, generally you're finishing these road races in a fatigued state of mind, so maybe leave like a note in your car or whatever that you did put a wheel in there, because
that's
you
can't.
It's quite easy and very often that you like you yourself, a teammate or a friend can leave their wheels with in a car.
And be nice to the neutral service person. It's not their fault that you flatted. And being riled up never helps. And they always remember who was mean to them. They will never forget. We had a small incident. It's in the past now, but we'll just say a certain neutral service still thinks poorly of us for one event that was like 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah.
So, it'd be nice.
Mind your P's and Q's.
Yeah, yes.
This actually happened at Sea Otter 1 year. Somebody put their wheel into the neutral service car, and it ended up being, it was a trainer tire on the wheel. And I asked him why he was doing that. He's like, it makes it easy to know which wheel is mine. Like, I get that, but don't do that. That will be a terrible tire on the road. A sticky note can work just fine.
Sure.
It's a whole lot easier. I guess that more or less covers the tactics side of things. One thing I did want to touch on, and we were talking about drivetrains there, and I realized that we didn't mention this before, but a lot of you are running one by drivetrains on your bikes because you are doing mostly criteriums, right?
I did. I can vouch for this. I ran a one by at the North Star Grand Prix this year, which is a, 6-day pro road tour, I believe is the shtick now, road race. So yeah, everything's from time trials.
And it worked just fine.
It worked just fine.
On Stillwater, you were dialed?
Yeah, I was
dialed.
Dang. Yeah.
You were going faster than I was.
I was, maybe for a little bit. I would say the problem.
He's an optimist.
Yeah, the problems there were not related to my drivetrain or gearing choices. Those were personal.
So what were you running what do you run for a chain ring, and then what do you run in the back on the cassette?
I ran a 52 in the front, 36 would have been my lowest gear. 11.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's
SRAM Wi-Fi. Derailleur.
That's a good setup to have.
And generally on a more day-to-day, I live in Sacramento, which is more or less flat, into the hills of Auburn and whatever. But I ran a 28 generally, a 28 standard 2811 cassette.
That makes sense. Yeah. And then Kevin, you were shaking your head the other way. you're a 2x guy, right?
Yeah. I mean, definitely. I may look like a climber, but I can't power like these guys, especially Thor and his quads. Like he can just power through, but I'm more of a guy that likes to spin.
Yeah.
So that little ring really helps, especially training in Colorado with the mountains we have, like
long,
just some long climbs. And
you pick the 5% ones.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You're at team camp and top of a mountain at 2,500 feet or whatever.
Yeah, I'll
so
see how they go.
Yeah, see how it works today.
Yeah.
Yeah. I ran one by last year, and I ran a 52 front ring and an 11-28 for racing most of the time and a 32 for training. And this year I did pick up a 54 tooth, and not in the crazy sense, but there were a couple races or a handful of races where I did want another gear, like on those long straights we were going. Mm-hmm. The 52-11, I'm not a spinner. Like I'm a not 80 to 90 RPM guy.
Yeah.
And I needed one more gear. I'd always try to click one more gear on those straights. And so I wouldn't say it would hold me back, but this year I am going to put a 54 on, like probably in a couple months, you know, once the racing actually starts. And I'm we'll see how that goes.
For road racing, in most cases, you guys would go for a 2x, I assume, if you're primarily doing road racing, sure. Right?
Yeah. If we did more than one pro road tour event a year, we would probably all run doubles.
But
for
there is there is something that I really liked. It was at Crybaby Hill, actually, where it's a big ring climb. I think everybody would agree with it. It's short. It's steep. However, in my job in that race, I wasn't racing for myself. I was racing for a teammate. And I was a bit cooked, probably 10 laps or so to go, and popping it into, and I actually tried to, and I kept my, that's just a weird way that I've set up my bike, is I kept my standard left shifter on with a paddle on it. You can obviously run it without it.
Dead paddle then.
Yeah, so it's a dead paddle. However, I just liked the kind of it felt symmetric with my hands and you just rest on it. So I kept it on there. And I actually went to click, so my job was to move somebody up. I moved them up. And I actually went to, and I was toasted, and I went to click it down, and I couldn't click it down, but it kept me on the gear, so I was able to get through it. Had I been able to shift into my small chain ring, there's no way that I was going to stay on for those last days. Yeah. But it doesn't give you an option, so.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
I will say that running a 1x actually made me a better a faster climber, not necessarily better, because you can only go so slow.
Right, and you can't put yourself through a 50 RPM.
You guys rode with AJ yesterday, and so you noticed that he could only go so slow, which is pretty uncomfortable most of the time, but in Boca and stuff like that, if I can only go so slow up a climb, that really actually helps me, because I would go slower if it was an option.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thanks, guys. I think we covered a lot of the specifics. And now we're going to go for a ride, which should be pretty fun. Up here. So if you're listening to this podcast, thanks so much. You can go to trainerroad.com/podcast and submit your questions for our normal style podcast where we answer your specific questions. You can leave us a review on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Google Play, or wherever else you're listening to this podcast. Thanks for listening, everybody. Talk to you next time.
Thanks, guys.
Well.